Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So have you ever stopped to think where the word okay comes from, or what the word what tells us about the English language, or why we pepper our speech with words like and? My next guest, David Crystal, describes our language as a vacuum cleaner, sucking in influence from class divides, technology, and other languages. Crystal is honorary professor of linguistics at the University of Wales, Bangor, and now author of The Story of English in 100 Words. Welcome back to WNYC, David Crystal.
Hi, Brian. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
And let's jump right in. Okay is one of those words that we say and hear and write several times a day, sometimes with two letters, sometimes with four. And yet it's one of the words with the most obscure origins. Where does okay come from, and what does it tell us about our linguistic history?
Oh, an awful lot. Yes, it's had some of the most frequent theories of all words. I mean, when I was checking this one out, I got up to 50 theories of the origins of OK before I gave up looking. But, you know, it has been sorted out now. There was a great lexicographer on your side of the pond called Alan Walker Reed, and a few years ago he did some stunning research into this. And what he showed was that way back in the 1830s in Boston, there was a huge game for inventing humorous abbreviations with initial letters. So somebody would say, for example, no use, but they'd spell it K-N-O-W-Y-U-S-E, you see, and they say K-Y, and that means no use. Well, okay came up along with that. It was a sort of humorous adaptation of the phrase all correct, spelled, of course, O-K. Now you think, why did that one survive and all the other abbreviations from the Boston paper at the time disappear? Well, that's because something else happened. Now you're in the middle of an election year at the moment, and in 1840 there was another election year. This time it was Martin Van Buren. He came from Old Kinderhook, OK, the name of his hometown in New York State. There was a Democratic OK club. The members were called the OKs. They had a war cry, you know, down with the Whigs, boys, OK. And it was that combination of the two things, the wordplay from the paper and the political jargon thing, that kept the phrase going.
And here we are saying it as a tick about 1,000 times a day in
at least
2012. There are hints of class distinctions in some of these word histories you have in this book. That's one of the most interesting things to me. Some 1% words, you might say, and some 99% words. For example, pork. Tell us about that.
Oh, pork, yeah. I mean, the history of English is, you said at the beginning, a vacuum cleaner. Absolutely right. Because originally, of course, it was a Germanic language in Anglo-Saxon times. And then along come the French in 1066 and thereafter. And they didn't just come in and revise all the politics and everything. They came in and revised the language as well. They looked back at these Anglo-Saxon words and found them a bit dirty, really, a bit downmarket, you know. And so they thought, you know, we have a very elegant way of talking in France. We'll impose some of these words onto English as well. And that's what they did. So whereas previously people would talk about eating pig, that was a bit too crude, really. We're going to eat pork now, you see. And similarly with words like sheep and veal and all of these words that came in at the time, there was a kind of rethinking of the way in which downmarket vocabulary could be upgraded to suit the more sensitive tastes of the French.
Very interesting. So, listeners, we've got a few minutes for your word, just one. Which word do you think tells an important story about how we live now? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What's the word you think can sum up the issues in the news and the issues which are most important in our lifestyles today? My guest is David Crystal, and he is game to talk about the histories of the word that you come up with if he happens to know it in his experience as a linguist. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. His book is called The Story of English in 100 Words. If you were putting a word in this book, what might it be? 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So the word debt is also there at number 40, a word much in use these days. And you write that the presence of the silent B tells us something about class as well.
Yes, it does indeed. You see, each one of the words in this book isn't there just because it's a fascinating word in its own right. It's because it illustrates a whole theme in the history of the language. And we've had a couple of examples already, and debt is another one. Because what happened to debt in the 16th century tells us a huge story about the development of English spelling. Now, spelling bees are big news in the United States, I know. And one of the things that makes every child that goes in for a spelling bee upset is the fact that there are so many of these silent letters. So where do they come from? Well, the interesting story here is that in the Middle Ages, the word debt was spelt very naturally, D-E-T. Yeah, nothing wrong with that, you might think, or D-E-T-T, or D-E-T-T-E, but there was no B there. And then in the 16th century, people said, hang on a minute, there are a lot of variations in this word. Let's standardize. Now, what's the best way of getting people to remember the word? And it was a classical century. People were very interested in Latin and Greek, and they thought like this. Let's go back to the origins of the word. And in Latin, the word debt was debitum, with a B. So let's put a B into the word, and that'll remind everybody. Everybody will be so pleased, they'll be so happy, because now they'll be able to remember the word okay. And you think, that'll never work. But 400 years later, how do we spell the word debt?
Here we
with
are.
With a B.
Michael in Queens has what I think is going to be an interesting question. Michael, you're on WNYC.
Good morning. I wanted to ask, I hear the word interesting so many times in news programs, radio, TV, and cable, including WNYC, that it's from the guests and the speakers say, this is very interesting. The results are very interesting. It's very interesting the pattern that's going on in the news here.
Do you not like the word for any reason?
No, I don't like the use of the word because of it's so broad, it's so general. It's always like when someone's about to say, or politicians, speakers, they pause 1 or 2 seconds and say,
Interesting. Yeah, if they can't, Michael, thank you. I agree. If they can't find a more specific adjective.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? Mm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's another one. Absolutely. You see, these are fashions. These things come and go. Any language needs words to give you sort of thinking time. And people come up with one and they use it and then it catches on. It becomes very noticeable and then people start talking about it like your caller has just done. And then people get fed up with it. It becomes a bit of a cliche and it dies away a little bit. And then something else will take over. So these things come and go over the years. Now, interestingly, the word interesting turns up in my 100 words as well, but in a slightly different connection because of this fascinating history of difference between whether you should say I'm disinterested or I'm uninterested. And that's an interesting story as well because it shows the way in which a word can go in two completely different directions.
Yes, because uninterested, you're bored, and disinterested, you're neutral.
You're being objective, that's right. But you ask most people what disinterested means, and they say it means I'm uninterested.
Yes.
And problem.
Nick and Summit, you're on WNYC with David Crystal, author of The Story of English in 100 Words. Hello.
Oh, hi. I'm calling about a word that's, I don't know how important it is, but I would say it's used certainly among young people, which is the word like. It's used, I don't know exactly.
It's used like every other word. So, like David Crystal, how did this become like the most used tick in the last 25 years?
Yeah, basic, isn't it? It's been in the language a long time, actually. You can trace this one back at least a couple of hundred years. Now, what's happened, though, that's made it fashionable is that it's come to be used, in linguistics we call it a quotative. It's the equivalent of quote marks, of inverted commas. So when I say I'm like... He's like, there, or whatever it might be. It's an emphatic way. And if you were writing that down, you'd put inverted commas at the beginning, inverted commas at the end, and it becomes like a sort of quotation. Now, what seems to have happened, is that a new style of conversation has emerged in which people are giving narratives all the time and telling people about what happened and what's going on. And you see this on the internet as well as in everyday face-to-face conversation. So the word like has come into being, really, as a kind of verbal tick, as you say, but the equivalent of quotation marks in writing.
And like really means two entirely different things. Did the two meanings come from different places? To like something and like meaning similar to?
Oh, originally go way back, and the two things come together. But they're different parts of speech, of course. I mean, you know, like being a verb and sometimes a noun, and then you've got like being a preposition. But, you know, if something is like something else, it's because there's a similarity there. And if I like you, it's because there's a similarity between us. Mm-hmm.
Isaac in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Same way you have with the French that changed the English in many ways, Yiddish have changed in America, in New York. Schlep.
Schlep. We say schlep now as if it's an English word. You got another one, Isaac?
Yes, I have another one. First of all, I want to say he mentioned the whole time, you know. So I became really part of the language, you know. You don't know what I know. But anyway, chutzpah.
Yeah.
Yes, or yeah, as Sarah Palin said, was it Sarah? No, it was Michelle Bachmann said, chutzpah, when she didn't know what it was, but she was trying to use it. So, yeah, schlep and chutzpah. Is schlep in your book?
Well, no, but schmooze is. I've got a whole chapter on Yiddish influence on English. I think this is a very important theme indeed, and I'm glad your caller has referred to it. Yeah, I mentioned schlep in the middle of the chapter, and also, you know, oh, schnozzle and schmaltz and schlemiel and schmuck, and oh, there are lots of them. And it's a really interesting feature, because English is not a language that likes the sh in front of a consonant at the beginning of a word. That's something you'd associate with German, for example, and, of course, Yiddish. So the fact that all these words have come into English has really not just added new words to the language, it's actually altered the sound structure, you know, the feel for the sounds of the language. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why they're so effective, this vocabulary.
And I wonder how this looks to you as a British linguist, or are you a Welsh linguist?
A bit of both, really.
That the words that influence American English come from so many places at this point, because this is a country of immigrants, Yiddish and other, and yet they reflect back to English.
Well, you know, that this immigrant history that you've got is only the most recent trend in the immigrant history of English as a whole, going back 1,500 years. You know, English, as you said, is a vacuum cleaner of a language. It sucks in words from every place it come into contact with. And as you go around the English-speaking world, you find that something like 600 languages have lent or, you know, given words to English at some time or another. And this goes right back into the Middle Ages, you know, before America was even invented, as it were. So what you're sensing over there is exactly the same sort of thing that we sensed over here at an earlier period.
And Andrea from Rockland on our webpage asks, how about the word indeed? And she says, a class indicator, indeed. And earlier in the program, she notes, we heard President Obama sort of mocking the word marvelous, or our producer notes, which Governor Romney used to describe the Republican budget. And Obama says, oh, yeah, that budget is marvelous. And then he said, who even uses the word marvelous?
Oh, right. Well, I think quite a lot of people still do use it, but you know, it only takes a comment like that and suddenly usage goes in two different directions. An awful lot of people will stop using the word, and then a lot of people will start using the word precisely because that's what he said. Yeah, indeed is another one. It's these adverbs, you know, like indeed and interestingly and absolutely and so on, they're always in the forefront of fashion. And they're the ones you notice, partly because they're used so frequently, they can turn up in all parts of the sentence, partly because they're very common in conversation. They attract interest and hold interest, but sometimes their history doesn't last for too long.
Did you consider adding the word occupy?
No, I haven't thought of that one. But then, you know, this is just my 100 words. This was my attempt to try and capture the story. Did the book, The History of the World in 100 Objects, ever come across your way, Brian? By a guy called Neil McGregor. He was director of the British Museum. He tried to tell the story of the history of the world by choosing 100 objects, each of which was a story in itself.
Yes, we're actually doing, just so you know, we're doing a series on each of those 100 objects on the Leonard Lopate Show, 1 o'clock, every day the last few months.
Oh, great stuff. Well, you know, this was exactly the idea with me, you see. If you can do the history of the world in 100 objects, can you do the history of the language in 100 words? And so they're my words. They're my choice. Any of your listeners choosing 100 would probably choose some different ones, but I think there'd be some similarities as well.
You end with word number 100, Twitterverse. Why did you go there?
Oh, the Twitter sphere. Well, you know, I wanted to bookend the book, and you find the first word is easy because it's the first recorded word in the English language, which is the word roe for a roe deer. And I wanted the last word in the English language, but that's impossible because, of course, every day there are new words. So I wanted to choose a word that looked to the future, and I chose Twittersphere precisely for that reason.
And from word number 9, riddle, to word number 15, arse, to word number 22, takeaway, to word number 97, muggle, ha, and 100, Twitterverse. It's the story of English in 100 words by linguist David Crystal. Fascinating and fun. Thank you very, very much.
That's a pleasure, Brian.